He said, I love you till I die. She told him, you'll forget in time. As the years went slowly by, she still preyed upon his mind. He kept her picture on his wall, went half crazy now and then, but he still loved her through it all, hoping she'd come back again. Kept some letters by his bed, dated 1962. He had underlined in red every single I love you. I went to see him just today. Oh, but I didn't see no tears. All dressed up to go away. First time I'd seen him smile in years. He stopped loving her today. It placed a wreath upon his door, and soon they'll carry him away. He stopped loving her today. You know, she came to see him one last time. Oh, and we all wondered if she would. And it kept running through my mind. This time, he's over her for good. He stopped loving her today. It placed a wreath upon his door. Soon they'll carry him away. He stopped loving her today.
A little George Jones there. It's another Sunday evening. Time once again for Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. Joining me today in the studio, Kathy Smith Bowers. Hey, Kathy, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Jeff. Yeah, thank you.
Excellent, excellent. Good to see you. I understand this is a, like, kind of a special day of some sort. Could it be your birthday,
Jeff,
or something like that?
It could be. It's a big one.
Oh,
big 6-0.
Oh, amazing. Yeah, yeah. That's if you out there in radio land could be, you know, like, if this were a TV program, you could see that that's a highly improbable statement. Yeah,
I would say speak into the microphone, Jeff, but you are.
That's right. That's right. Well, Kathy, thanks so much for coming up the mountain and visiting today.
It's always delightful to drive up this way.
Well, we're glad we could provide you an occasion. Yeah. So you have a new book out.
I do.
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. Good. Tell us a bit about that book.
This book is called The Candle I Hold Up to See You, and it's published by Iris Press. They always do a wonderful job.
They've done most of your books, right?
Yes, yeah. They've done, actually, my first book was done by Texas Tech University Press.
Right.
And Iris Press, when it went out of print, Iris Press brought it out in paperback. And then they've published my second, third, and fourth books. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and done beautiful work with them.
They do wonderful work.
Yeah.
They really do.
Well, this one looks great too, and it's also got some fine work in it.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, really been enjoying reading it. So why don't you actually read a poem? Tell us, you know, these are different, I would say.
They are different. Yeah. It is a different book. The subject of the book is actually language itself, speech. The book is has an epigraph from an Alan Shapiro poem, and the poem is called Turn, and the epigraph is speech is the candle I hold up to see you.
Mm-hmm.
And
nice, yeah.
Then there's a second epigraph by Thomas Hostat. Metaphor is neither the candle nor the wick, but the burning. And I thought that both of those were very appropriate for the kinds of poems that I had been writing for the last few years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Many of the poems are about, you know, I'll just take an individual word and just explore the different connotations, different meanings of that particular word.
Mm-hmm. Is that just particularly true of the names of God section?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But how is that different from the way poetry has worked for you in the past?
It really is. For all of my writing life, my mantra was to not to begin with an idea, but with an image,
mm-hmm.
what I came to call an abiding image, and. So in the last year or so, I've really wondered if I could actually write a poem that was not a narrative poem and to do something closer to the lyric. And so I started working with a group of poems from the Kabbalah. I was going to do a whole book called The 72 Names of God.
Mm-hmm.
There would be one poem for each of the names of God, which meant that I would start with an idea instead of an image.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was very interesting. I wrote 8 poems and decided that God had too many names. And so
right.
instead of being a separate book, those 8 poems ended up being the first section in The Candle I Hold Up to See You.
Right. Right.
And I was able to write, you know, to do more of the lyric type poem for about 2 pages, and then I went straight back to the narrative.
Yeah, I was going to say there's no lack of narrative in this work.
Yeah, but it was an interesting experience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But even some of the narratives are about language in this one.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah,
absolutely.
Like syntax and so on.
Yeah.
So yeah, yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, let's hear a poem or two.
Okay. I'll read one of the poems from the 8 Names for God section.
Okay.
These poems are odd in another way too. They don't have titles. Each poem has the actual 3 Hebrew characters.
Mm-hmm.
That would represent that particular name of God.
Okay.
And the idea is that we bring these names of God into the world with us on the DNA level, but we sort of lose touch with them because of the clutter and dailiness of life. So the idea, according to the Kabbalah, is that if we will just look at the letters of the names of God, then we can re-trigger that particular name of God within us.
Mm-hmm.
So I will read the poem that, imagine that you're looking, not looking at a title, but at 3 Hebrew letters. And a big challenge was to try to make it come clear to the reader what this particular name of God had to do with. So I hope that will be clear. So just imagine you're looking at 3 Hebrew letters. So this is the name I might have called upon when I needed of my latest childhood ailment to be healed. But who in her right mind would have chosen in those days to be rendered well? the way my mother pampered me, yes, loved me more than all the rest when I was ill. All day her smooth hand grazed my fevered brow, the clean warm cloth tucked soft between the poultice she had rubbed into my chest and the flannel gown I'd lounged inside for days. Finally, just the two of us, the others packed off to school, my father to the mill to pull his double shift, and always my mother's ironing board erected close to my couch turned into bed. Steam rose like angels from my father's khaki shirts as the days of other people's lives flickered their bright promise across the black and white. My stories, she called them, the only thing she claimed that kept her sane. She didn't know the word sane meant health. Neither did I until years later, French 101, when the teacher demonstrated for us all a proper Parisian toast. I votre sane, she spoke in her most elegant dialect, then raised a ghostly vessel to the class. To your health, in any language this name of God proclaims, the only name I know to call upon now that she is gone.
Nice. Yeah, enjoy that one. Yeah, well, let's hear another of these names.
Okay, you want to hear another of the names of God?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right, let me go back to one of the earlier ones and show you how, about as close as I can come to what I think is a true lyric poem.
Okay. Oh, wow.
I don't know why I said true lyric poem. I don't think it's got a story to it.
Okay, we'll see.
Okay. Yeah. And this begins with a quote from an Emily Dickinson poem. Heavenly hurt, Miss Emily called it. Imperial affliction sent us of the air. We've all been there. Yet here is the name that says we can reclaim those sparks that once emblazoned us. Like the stars we walk beneath each night, their own light dead for eons, we are told. Though there they are above the browning ash and oak, strung high before our eyes in the wintry limbs. Little Promethei of our dampered souls, go forth and high, plunder for us now those still bright realms of sky.
That's very nice too. Yeah, and that is very different. I mean,
it's lyric,
got a different voice.
I mean, yeah. it doesn't have a story. It's just reflecting and pondering on this name of God that is supposed to, if we concentrate on it, is supposed to bring us out of depression. Mm-hmm. You know, Miss Emily Dickinson struggled with that quite a bit. So.
Right. Yeah, that's very...
I'm always amazed when I write a poem that doesn't lapse into telling some long, drawn-out story.
That's a nice one, though. Yeah. You had several in the Book of Hours that were more meditative. And
I did. Yeah. That and those, the Book of Minutes.
Book of Minutes,
designed according to the Book of Hours. Yeah. But yeah, those little poems that have only 60 syllables, they sort of don't allow you enough room to tell a story,
right?
Even though I managed every now and then. So a lot of those were leaning more toward the lyric.
Was that the constraint that you set for yourself, that they had to have 60 syllables?
They had 60, each poem has only 60 syllables in it.
I'd forgotten that. Right. Yeah.
And a rhyme scheme of A-A-B-B-C-C, on and on and on and on, 60 syllables at least.
Yeah. Do you generally set constraints for yourself of that sort? Not in your
No, I don't. As a matter of fact, I always, you know, was always happy with free verse and never thought I would be interested in writing in form. Mm-hmm. And my beautiful brother, my youngest brother, died. And that's why I started working in that form. I thought it would be a safe container for me to begin writing again with. Mm-hmm. And I just fell in love with the form, and 4 years later, I was still writing in
still
that form.
In it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you ever go back to that now? Have you?
I haven't. But I tell you, I honestly don't find free verse as much of a challenge as I did. So I've started working in some other traditional forms, like the villanelle and the Persian form called the ghazal.
Oh yeah, the ghazal.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, excellent.
I hate that it's pronounced ghazal.
Ghazal.
But
I know. Right? It's not a wonderful
That's
word
not
in
just
English.
My southern accent.
Right. No, indeed. Yeah. So, but there are none of those. I don't recall villanelles. Is there a villanelle in this book?
No.
No, I didn't think so. Yeah. So you.
Most of these poems are free verse. Yeah, yeah. Long free verse. Because after, you know, working in that tight little 60 syllable.
You were ready to break loose.
I did break loose. Yeah. Yeah. And some of these are more like essays disguised as poems, I think. Yeah.
Well disguised, though.
Thank you.
Oh. Well, let's hear another little bit of George Jones.
All right.
Imagine a world where no music was playing. Then think of a church with nobody praying. If you've ever looked up at a sky with no blue, then you've seen a picture of me without. In a garden where nothing was growing, or stood by a river when nothing was flowing. If you seen a red rose unkissed by the dew, then you've seen a picture of me without you. Can you picture heaven with no angels singing, or a quiet Sunday morning with no church bells ringing? If you've watched as the part of a child breaks in two, then you've seen a picture of me without you.
A little more George Jones. Probably the first time George Jones has been played here at Asheville FM. Except for the September show, where I reprised the two wordplay episodes that you'd done previously. So
I'm glad to know I've done something worthwhile for the rest of the world.
That's right. You've introduced George Jones. Are you planning to do a book on George Jones? You should.
It just occurred to me. I need to write some poems to George Jones, or inspired by George Jones.
Yeah. You've been listening to George for a long time.
I've been listening to George for a long time. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. What do you, when you, you know, when you're working, does it help you to have music playing?
No, it doesn't. No, I can't hear anything. I can't have any noise going on at all.
Really? Yeah. So not even a loud clock. What about a loud clock?
No.
Okay. You really like silence.
Yes.
Yeah. So where do you find that? You must have a very quiet house.
I do have a quiet house, and I usually, you know, when I have some time to write, it's usually in the morning. I don't allow myself to turn on any TV or music or radio or even printed words like the newspaper. I wouldn't dare do that before I write. I try to stay as close to the dream state as I can. About the only thing that comes between me and sleep and then writing is coffee. I have to have two cups of coffee.
Yes.
I have to.
Yeah. Decaf or regular?
Regular. Strong.
Straight up.
Strong.
Interesting. And how long do you generally write? Do you get hungry, probably?
Yeah. I mean, it's. I really love if I can have the morning until around lunchtime.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, that wears me out. So I don't, you know, if I get the chance to write until lunchtime, then I don't do any more writing.
Right.
That day.
Yeah. Writing is hard work, as anyone who's sat down with a piece of paper and a pen can realize. Yeah.
If you know, it's you when you get that focused and when you go into what I think of as the writer's trance, it really is tiring.
Yeah, it sure requires a lot of energy, right? You burn a lot of caffeine up there.
And it makes you really tired when you see what you wrote and realize how bad it is.
Right. And you have to redo it all. And, you know, there's the process of revision that we all love and so on.
Yeah.
Do you revise much?
I revise obsessively.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes.
Right.
Obsessively.
Yeah.
Yes, I often sit at home on Saturday night analyzing syntax.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
It's a fun way to spend Saturday.
Yeah. I love it. Yeah.
For a poet, anyway.
I do. I'm a slow writer, and I dwell on every word.
Mm-hmm.
Not in the first stages of writing. I let the unconscious... You know, I write very quickly, and it's a big mess, and I refer to it as my big, messy hunk of stone.
Mm-hmm.
But in the later stages of the process, I dwell on every word and go to the unabridged dictionary, and it's pretty obsessive.
Yeah, delve in.
Here's what we've done is poets have found a way to legitimize obsessive compulsive disorder. I'm convinced of that.
Oh, it's one good use of it.
Shall we say? Yeah, it's a good. I guess that's better. That's a nicer, kinder way to put it.
Oh, well, I noticed. In this book, as in your others, many of the poems go back to that first family, the primal family, the mother, the father, the brother. Is that, and you know, there's later on a husband thrown in for good measure.
Or two,
right?
Yeah.
But is that where poets work from?
It certainly is where I work from. I think the family is the greatest mystery there is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my biggest emotional investment is with family. So obviously not for other, you know, not for all poets, but it's sort of like me trying to write lyric poems. I also can't write poems that, you know, a family member doesn't appear in or something.
Right.
Every once in a while I do, though. But I can't imagine. I will always write about my family.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I always go back to.
Yeah. And some of your most amazing poems come from that.
I think so. Yeah. I think so. The poems that I like and am happiest with mm-hmm. are poems about my family.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there are some of those in this new book, too. Why don't you share one of those?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I haven't read this one in a while. This is a poem that the title comes from something that my mother used to threaten us with, and this, I'm probably not the only child who heard this, but my mother would often threaten to beat the living daylights out of us.
Oh, yeah. Good expression. Good Southern, right.
Sometimes she'd say stomp the living daylights. Other times beat the living daylights. So I just, with this poem as the other ones in the book, I took that phrase and just wrote into the mystery of it. So this is called The Living Daylights. She'd beat it out of all of us, she warned, if we dared defy her rules, tried her thinning patience one more time. Truth is, she never laid a hand on anyone. Though once, for some small forgotten truancy, she snatched me without warning from my play, swatting at my behind with a belt she had grabbed from its too convenient hook on the closet door. And oh, what a sight together there we made, round and round the living room, a windmill, top, fine whirligig, bright wheel, and she the axis to my screeching spoke. By the time she finally seated me the win, not a lick had grazed the small but quicker shins that carried me bruise-free into womanhood. I, who fared no worse than the neighbor kids who bore into the world deep marks of defter hands. She's gone now, benign and hopeless queen of discipline, the living daylights beaten in the end out of all of us.
Nice.
Thank you.
But, as you know, that again turns on a phrase. As many of the poems in the book do,
they start
with language,
mm-hmm.
yeah,
mm-hmm.
even if they get into family narrative or, you know, whatever
yes.
this Southern
yes.
thing is that, yeah,
uh-huh.
yeah,
yeah,
yeah, nice. Well, let's hear some more of the book.
Okay.
Pick another one. You've been doing readings around the area. You read at Malaprops.
Yeah.
Where'd you read most recently?
I read at City Lights bookstore
nice little store.
Yes, yeah. It was lovely.
Right,
and I'd never been in there before, so.
Oh, good.
Really enjoyed it. This is another one that I haven't read. Don't read much, so I'll do this one.
Okay.
This poem was written after my youngest sister, Rosie, who's only 15 months younger than I am, had cancer, and we really were scared that we were going to lose her. And she had to do chemo, but she did the chemo that you actually wear like a shoulder bag, so that she had it all the time.
Yeah, constant infusion.
Yes,
yeah.
And what I'm doing is exploring a moment at the mall after she started feeling like going back out again. And of course she had that
still had her
the chemo bag on her shoulder. Yeah,
yeah.
So this is an odd little moment that took place. It's called Cool Radio. When she calls and asks if I will drive her to the mall, our city's newest labyrinth of glittering stuff, I know my sister has come back to me. Back from November's shock of blood, the exams, the x-rays, the surgeon's winnowing blade. She is 1 week out of the hospital, chemo bag draped casually across her shoulder, spilling its slow promise into her veins. Odd how stylish in the mall's fluorescent lights, a Gucci or Von Furstenberg, its pale blue plastic, shiny as the toy shoes and purses we used to play grown-up in. I loop my left arm through her frail right, her tired gait lanky, almost chic. Steady her against the teenage throng, tattooed and pierced and spiked, past racks of skirts and dresses, tier upon tier of stiletto heels, like the ones our dead mother in her younger years suffered so beautifully in. At the base of the escalator, beyond the limited and the gap, a girl too young for fashion's fleeting realm spies the apparatus around my sister's neck. "Cool radio," she whispers to no one as we all step on together.
Cool radio, yeah.
That's what I call an abiding image, just that little phrase, cool radio.
Yeah.
That haunted me until I sat down and worked through this poem.
Right, right. So, but that's, again, a linguistic abiding image.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yes.
Right. What, you know, usually when I think of image, I'm thinking of something that's, you know,
visual.
Visual, like an interior sea lighted by turning eagles or something like that. But
for me, I include any of the senses. I might sit down and work with a smell, or a texture, word, you know, maybe a phrase of a song. So any of the senses might come drifting back, and then I would sit down with that, what I call that abiding image, and write into the mystery of it.
Like Proust with the croissant or the Madeleine.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Yeah, the whole complex brought back.
Right.
Retrouvé, Interesting, yeah. Well, this has the new book. For those, by the way, for those of you who don't have this book, you should definitely go out and buy a copy at your nearest bookstore. It's really a fine book.
Yeah.
And once again, it's The Candle I Hold Up to See You by Kathy Smith Bowers. You're listening to Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. Let's have a little change of musical pace here.
Not a sound, it's not one sound, just the beat of my poor heart in the dark. Now in the dark, such a thrill when he presses his fingertips upon my lips and he begs me to please keep still in the dark. Missed. what the rest have left behind. Just let them dance. We're gonna find our man's Lord in the dark.
A little Nina Simone. That's your homegirl. She's from Tryon.
My homegirl.
Yeah, amazingly enough. Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She was born and grew up there, and I keep thinking that she walked in my yard. I've got that in my mind.
You think so?
I think she walked in my yard, yeah.
Well, yeah. That would be an honor to for that to have happened.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. So when do you listen to music during the day? If you're not, you don't listen to it when you're writing.
I don't. I will... sometimes in the evening when I've finished all my work, I might get a glass of wine. And I usually put on Nina Simone, George Jones, or Leonard Cohen. I'm a creature of habit.
Tried and true.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Reliable.
Don't get tired of them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, there's something very enduring about their work. Mm-hmm. For sure. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Can't get much better than those three. And they're very different. Very different.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of soul or whatever one calls that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're doing the same thing. It's just their styles different, I guess.
Working on different genres.
As I said
different.
About George, you know, they all will break your heart and stomp it into the ground.
Right. Right. Something we allow music to do for us, not others.
Yeah.
Well, good, good. Well, I tell you what, let's hear another poem.
Okay,
what do you think?
I'll read you my poem that sort of, this is one I think that you might like, Jeff. Syntax. This sort of has a kind of a poor, poor, pitiful me tone to it, you know. I bet George or Nina could have put this to music and sung it, maybe. This poem goes, there's an image of one of the first poems I ever wrote. When I first started writing poems, I tried to sound as much like Edgar Allan Poe as I could. Did a pretty good job of it. And I wrote a poem once that had a line that I liked so much that I kept repeating it. And the line was, "Where haunts the ghost after the house is gone?" Oh, man, I like that.
Which is wonderful.
Unfortunately, we don't talk like that. So I couldn't get away with that, having a poem out there with that line in it, "Where haunts the ghost after the house is gone?" So I wrote a poem about trying to write a poem with that line in it.
There you go.
And this poem could really be a cautionary tale for any creative writing teacher. It's called Syntax. "Where haunts the ghost after the house is gone?" I once wrote. First line of my first poem in my first creative writing class. I'd been reading Byron, Keats, and Shelley, lots of Poe. Loved how the cadence of their words fit the morass my life had fallen to. I had stayed up all night counting stressed and unstressed syllables, my mother's weeping through the door of her shut room, echoing the metrics of my worried words. It was the year our family blew apart, my mother, brothers, and sisters and I fleeing in the push-button rambler with no reverse an uncle had taught me to drive. I loved that poem. Finally knew how words the broken and bereft could alchemize. Couldn't wait to get to class. Could hear already in my mind that teacher's praise. When it came my turn to read, the paper trembled in my hand. my soft voice cracked. Years passed before I reached the final word, before she took the glasses from her nose and cocked her head. "You've skewed your syntax up," was all she said. I remember nothing else about her class. That spring, her house burned down. She died inside. Where haunts the ghost after the house is gone? I had several alibis.
That's a lot of fun. A lot of fun.
I had fun writing that one.
Yeah, I bet. So when did you start writing? How did you come into this curious endeavor?
In high school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My parents both, even though they were uneducated, and even though they hated each other, they loved language.
Mm-hmm.
They both loved language. So I think somewhere in my warped child's mind, I thought maybe if I became a poet, mm-hmm. that they might, you know.
They might approve like you.
Maybe they'd like me and like each other since they had me.
Yeah, yeah.
That's your skewed.
Yeah, you can be the bridge.
Logic. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, right. And then I wrote poems in high school that sounded a lot like Edgar Allan Poe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then in college, I took a modern American poetry. Actually, modern British poetry.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And then contemporary American poetry, and I thought, wow, you can still be alive and write poems.
What a concept!
You can write poems and with natural human speech, and mm-hmm. that people can actually understand. And I was hooked.
Mm-hmm. Who did you read in that class?
I fell in love with Phil. This was a contemporary American mm-hmm. poetry. Philip Levine.
Uh-huh. So this is circa, 1970?
Yeah.
Something
mm-hmm.
like there? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Philip Levine, Richard Wilbur, even though Richard Wilbur's always written in form.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
James Dickey.
Oh, yeah.
Elizabeth Bishop. And, of course, Sylvia Plath and Anne Sexton. And, let's see. Those were... Oh my God, Seamus Heaney.
Oh, yeah. Before the Nobel.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the ones that really come to mind right now.
For
different reasons. Mm-hmm. I still think that James Dickey's poems, 1957 to 67, that he won the Pulitzer for, is just one of the most amazing collections of poems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he's underrated because of his later work or his later
reputation.
Yeah.
But that's too bad though. It'll
mm-hmm.
I think people
Things will straighten themselves out in the long haul.
I mean Robert Hayden loved his poems. James Wright.
I was just thinking James Wright. Yeah. He seems like someone you
James Wright, and now his son, Franz Wright.
Oh, yes, right.
Who won the Pulitzer Prize for Walking to Martha's Vineyard.
Yeah.
Just wonderful, wonderful, haunting stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, good, yeah. So did you take a writing, did you enroll in a writing program as such? Did you take creative writing?
No.
Yeah.
I don't even know if they had creative writing.
Back then,
Yeah.
Where were you in school?
Winthrop.
At Winthrop, mm-hmm.
For my bachelor's degree and my master's degree. But,
mm-hmm.
yeah, it's mostly literature courses where I, just fell in love with what those poets were doing,
mm-hmm.
with language and just real life human voices
mm-hmm.
speaking.
Yeah.
Of deeply moving things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, look, William Carlos Williams.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, reaching a little further back, right.
Yeah.
Did you ever get into Eliot and Pound and all those, the earlier cats?
I wasn't a big...
The modernist, quick.
Yates.
Oh, yeah.
Yates. I mean, still...
Still an astounding poet,
Yeah, and two, earlier than that, who I think, you might not know it to read my poems, but I believe that I was heavily influenced by John Donne and Gerard Manley Hopkins.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah.
So those were two of my loves that went way back.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
They were skewing syntax up and everything.
Right. Right.
Maybe that's probably why I wrote "Where Haunts the Ghost After the House Is Gone."
more than Poe, it might have been.
Right. You're probably right. Yeah. Donna, I can't blame Poe for that one. Maybe. Dunn and Hopkins.
Yeah, Hopkins especially might have like played with that a bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, good. Excellent. Let's hear one more track here.
I left a note on his dresser, and my old wedding ring with these few goodbye words. Goodbye, old sleepy head. I'm packing you in like I said. Take care of everything. I'm leaving my wedding ring. Don't look for me. I'll get ahead.
Jeff Davis in the studio today, Kathy Smith Bowers. That was really interesting, Nina Simone, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Very open structure mm-hmm. to the song, yeah. Not your usual refrain and verse and refrain sort of thing. Yeah, yeah. She was terrific. And
pretty amazing, yeah.
Yeah.
Our little town's going to dedicate the memorial in February to her.
Oh, really?
Yeah. A beautiful piece of a sculpture of her.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that's nice. I didn't know that.
I don't know how she's going to feel about coming back home to Tryon.
Yeah. You know. Yeah, they've had a distant relationship.
Yeah.
I wonder if she's been back. I don't know enough of her biography to know if she's returned.
Well, I would say no. She
went about as far from trying as she
did.
Could get.
She became an expatriate.
Right. Yeah.
But her daughter, Lisa, who is a marvelous singer too, came last year, and I got to meet her. And she was thinking about actually moving back with her husband and her daughter. She has a lovely CD called Simone on Simone. Her name is Lisa Simone.
Oh yeah.
So it was the daughter singing the mother's work.
Oh yeah.
So it was really nice meeting her.
Yeah.
Beautiful, yeah. Beautiful person.
How old would she be now? She must.
I don't know. She looks. I think she looks. I have no idea. I think she has a grown son. She has a little daughter, but she also has a grown son who is a minister, so he's out there, you know. So, but I don't know.
Yeah. Further research required.
Yeah. I really am thinking about writing a sequence of poems about Nina Simone and, you know, that maybe a crown of sonnets. I've had that in mind.
A crown of sonnets.
Yeah. Do you know what that is?
Tom Meyer once explained what a crown of sonnets to me, what a crown of sonnets is to me.
Yeah.
Those are our listeners who have never seen a crown of sonnets.
A crown of sonnets is a sequence of sonnets. You actually have 14 sonnets.
Right.
And the second sonnet begins with the last line of the previous sonnet.
Right.
And so that goes all the way through. And then in the 14th sonnet, you take a line from every one of the preceding ones, and they've got to all make sense together. maybe that's not such a good idea after all. Maybe I'll write a haiku. How about a haiku?
Or a series of haikus.
Yeah. But yeah, I have been thinking about writing something about Nina Simone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And clearly, it sounds like you're interested in form again at this point.
Yeah.
If you're mentioning the lamelles and puzzles and sonnets.
I still think the sonnet is the loveliest form.
Mm-hmm.
Just a beautiful form. So.
Yeah. As you say, it's beauties. And I'll have to recommend it. Yeah.
Yeah. I had a sequence of sonnets in The Candle I Hold Up to See You, and my publisher asked kindly for me to take them out. And he said that he would, if I took those out, he would let me put in the eight names for God.
Oh yeah, okay, all so right.
Well, it was a compromise.
Okay, I want to see those sonnets at some point, though. I wonder if I could put in a request, though, today.
You sure can.
Yeah, I wonder if you'd read Shadow Dancing.
I would love to. Thank you.
Yeah,
it's one of my favorite poems to read.
Yeah, and it's a mighty good one.
Thank you. This poem is, I mentioned my youngest brother who died of AIDS in 1997. He was beautiful. He was the light of our lives. And so this poem really recreates two of my most abiding images. And they both have to do with dancing, which I still to this day have a fear of getting up and dancing. And this poem sort of explains why. But my brother was a wonderful dancer during the disco era. And, of course, Shadow Dancing, the title, is the title of a song that was sung and made famous by Andy Gibb, a cousin of the Bee Gees.
Mm-hmm.
And Andy Gibb died at a very young age.
Right.
So this begins with an image from my undergraduate days at Winthrop. It was my last semester. I still had, we had to take 4 PE classes, and I still had one more to go. The only thing that was available for me to take was modern dance.
Ooh.
And my teacher was about 90 years old, and mean as a snake. And so there's also an allusion toward the end of the poem to a couple of dances that were popular during the disco era, the hustle and the bus stop. Both of those are...
Yeah, I don't remember the bus stop. The hustle, I remember. But yeah.
Oh, the bus stop was fun. It was a line dance.
A line dance.
Yes,
okay.
And my brother, you know, he was great at all of these dances. Okay. So this poem is called Shadow Dancing. I wish Miss Salo could have seen the night my brother said go limp, then swirled me in his arms across the discotheque, light and lithe, more graceful than I had ever been, she who had put an end to my dancing days. She was tiny and all pruned up, like those photos I never understood of vegetables dressed like people, ribbed peppers sporting glasses, tomatoes in tutus and tiaras. She carried a big stick, nudged to attention our clavicles and ribs if we slouched in our pliés or rendered too soft our arabesques. I tried to do what she instructed, pretended to be that leaf fluttering from its tree. Oh, down and twirling down I went, landing in a tangled mass amidst the fine and tutored elegance of the other girls. When she shouted, "Stop!" it took a moment to realize she was talking to me, though grace of some sudden other kind made her wait until later to relegate me to the stool by the record player, where until semester's end I would raise and lower the needle at her command. So it was she I thought of years later in the unschooled pedagogy of my brother's arms, beautiful in his white suit, the pink shirt with pearl buttons he would keep for years, long after the disease had ravaged him, the bus stop and the hustle having entered too oblivion's faithful realm. Go limp was all he said, and I did. Each lift and trill of the Bee Gees' bright falsettos waking the long, muted language of my body. Even Andy was not dead yet.
Nice. Yeah.
Thank you for asking for that one. Every time I read it, I'm back in my brother's arms, and it just... It really is very comforting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Was he younger?
He was the youngest of six.
Yeah.
He was our baby. He was the light of our lives.
Yeah. Where were you in this succession of...
I was lost in the middle.
In the middle.
Yeah.
A middle child.
Yeah. Had an older sister and an older brother, and then a younger sister and two younger brothers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Big family. Where'd you grow up?
Lancaster, South Carolina.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which was last year, Forbes magazine named it the most vulnerable town in the entire
country, Kathy said. And there the stream to the archive stopped. We might have said a few more words, but it was the end of the hour, and I thanked her for coming in to do the show and closed out by saying, "That's Wordplay for this week. Tune in again next week when we'll once again bring poetry to the airwaves of the internet." Thanks for listening.
I loved you in the morning, our kisses deep and warm, your hair upon the pillow like a sleepy golden storm. Yes, many love before us. I know that we are not new. In city and in forest, they smiled like me and you. But now it's come to distances, and both of us must try. Your eyes are soft with sorrow. Hey, that's no way to say goodbye. not looking for another as I wander in my time. Walk me to the corner, our steps will always rhyme. You know my love goes with you as your love stays with me. It's just the way it changes like the shoreline and the sea. But let's not talk of love or chains and things we can't untie. Your eyes are soft with sorrow. Hey, that's no way to say goodbye. I loved you in morning, our kisses deep and warm, your head on the pillow like a sleepy golden storm. Yes, many love before us, I know that we are not new. In city and in forest they smiled like me and you. But let's not talk of love or chains and things we can't untie. Your eyes are soft with sorrow. Hey, that's no way to say goodbye.